somehow it came to mind during the last week that it might be helpful to talk about the topic of how compassion relates to wisdom. So I could call this Dharma talk Wisdom and Compassion, and with the subtitle of Living in the World of Consequences. We come to practice, perhaps, well, for many different reasons, but one of the reasons we can come to practice is looking for a deeper sense of peace and freedom. And that deeper sense of peace and freedom gets associated with wisdom. And we can have various experiences of that or understandings of that, and that's all fine and good. Sometimes our experience of wisdom can seem to exclude the experience of compassion, the experience of what it's like to live in the world of consequences. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit and explore some ideas about that. To begin with, there's a teaching that Reverend Master Daizui used to say, which is that if you want to understand wisdom, if you want to have a deeper experience of wisdom, work on compassion. And I think that's I have taken that to heart and make it my own approach to my practice and to the cultivation of wisdom in my life. And so that's my foundation for it, and then we can look at some various things. I was reminded this morning of a book called The Unborn, which is a book about the life and teaching of Zen Master Bankai, who's a Japanese Rinzai master from the 15th century. And he, well, actually from the 17th century, he was a little bit unusual in his teaching methods, but still is viewed as a fairly great Zen master from Japan. So I wanted to read some things from that book and then comment on them and tie them back into our idea of how wisdom and compassion relate. I really like the way he ties in Buddha nature, Buddha mind, and wisdom, and he has such an expansive view of people. He never excludes anyone from having Buddha mind or wisdom. He is always very inclusive in his teaching. So he says, "What I call the unborn is the Buddha mind. This Buddha mind is unborn with a marvelous virtue of illuminative wisdom. In the unborn, all things fall right into place and remain in perfect harmony." This is kind of what the idea that I was talking about. We come to practice looking for this deeper experience of life, this deeper sense of peace and wisdom, this deeper connection to life. And this type of description begins to point us in the direction of wisdom. "When everything you do is done according to the unborn, the eye that sees others as they are opens in you. And you know in your mind, in your own mind, that everyone you see is a living Buddha. That's the reason why once you live in the unborn, you never fall back into your old ways, just like that old woman of Sanuki. Once you know the great worth of the Buddha mind, you can't leave it for illusion again. But as long as you're ignorant of its great value, you will continue to create illusions for yourself in whatever you do, insignificant things included, and you will live as an unenlightened person." So we can hear a paragraph like that and think, you know, yeah, that's what I want. That's where I want to go. That's what I want to get. And so then we start to practice, we can put the teaching into practice, we start a meditation practice, and then we might actually have an experience where we know that that Buddha mind lives in us, that it's alive and is there. And you can think then, there's a few details in here that he says, you can think then, whatever I do from this experience of the Buddha mind is going to be good and right. It's going to be the correct thing to do, the harmonious thing to do. It's going to be right even if people raise objections to what I'm doing. There was a small example of this that I heard about. There was a fellow Canadian man who was being was brought to court for he was being sued or prosecuted for having too many wives. He married too many women. And he was the leader of a small Christian cult. And one of the things he said, there was some testimony from one of his wives who was pretty upset. And one of the things he said in response to that, either in the courtroom or afterwards, was that if you're upset by something that I have done, then the problem is yours. It's not my problem. The problem is yours if you're upset. And in a sense, there is some truth in what he is saying. In a sense, let me underline that. There's some truth in that. And in that way, we can take our little bit of experience of wisdom and use it to justify our own wrong actions. We can use it to justify our own greed, our own elusive actions. So in other words, this man, I think there was a pretty strong case for saying that he was a little bit mistaken in his view of how to live in the world, of correct action according to being in harmony with Buddha nature, and was creating a fairly big wake of suffering. And the interesting thing about it was that it takes that little bit of experience of wisdom and distorts it in such a way as to create suffering. In other words, he takes what he's experienced and run with it in a direction that has created consequences that are unpleasant for him and others. We need to be quite careful about that. So when Bonke says, that's the reason why once you live in the unborn, you never fall back into your old ways. We should understand that there is a profound way in which this is quite true. And we also need to understand that the path of training is quite long. And there are many subtle issues that we need to embrace and understand as we go along. We can have a small awakening to the truth and still allow delusive habits from the past to influence us. And part of our awakening to the truth is recognizing that that happens. There's a famous quote, a Zen quote that you might encounter, which goes, sometimes I raise the eyebrows of Shakyamuni Buddha, sometimes I do not. Or it is said, we go in and we go out. Sometimes we give expression to Buddha nature and sometimes we do not. This is the normal state of things. Sometimes when we're giving expression to Buddha nature, So we give expression to Buddha nature and sometimes we don't. Sometimes when we don't give expression to Buddha nature, it's just life. We're just going in and out. We're just not raising the eyebrows of Shakyamuni Buddha. But we also have the possibility in those times of doing wrong action, of doing things which are distorted, which are in a sense counter-perceptual, to use that shorthand term for an action which causes suffering. sometimes when we're acting from Buddha nature, we can actually behave in a way that isn't skillful or doesn't respond in a way that the beings around us can understand. It's also another possibility. So part of our ongoing training is how to cultivate skill, how to cultivate skill and means. There's another little section of this that I wanted to read that talks about this. The unborn Buddha mind deals freely and spontaneously with anything that presents itself to it. But if something should happen to make you change the Buddha mind into thought, then you run into trouble and lose that freedom. Let me give you an example. Suppose a woman is engaged in sewing something. A friend enters the room and begins speaking to her. As long as she listens to her friend and sews in the unborn, she has no trouble doing both. But if she gives her attention to her friend's words and a thought arises in her mind as she thinks about what to reply, her hands stop sewing. If she turns her attention to her sewing and thinks about that, she fails to catch everything her friend is saying, and the conversation does not proceed smoothly. In either case, her Buddha mind has slipped from the place of the unborn. She has transformed it into thought. As her thoughts fix upon one thing, they are blank to all others, depriving her mind of its freedom. In another place, Bhante says, in his temple, he doesn't have a time when training begins and a time when training ends. Every moment is training. Every moment is the effort to grasp the will and put our minds into the place of the unborn. Now, part of that, again, is it is also true that, again, sometimes we raise the eyebrows of Shakyamuni Buddha, sometimes we do not. Part of our activity of life, part of the thing that being in harmony with Buddha mind does, is it allows for the possibility of thinking as an activity. And sometimes that's the necessary activity that we must engage in. So we shouldn't get into a mind which is dualistic, which says, I can either do this thing, I can either be in the Buddha mind or I can be thinking. That is unhelpful. What I want to draw our attention to is the necessity of responding from our sense of what is good to do in the moment, what is good to do as a positive step forward. And that comes from being grounded in that Buddha mind. That comes from being grounded in Buddha nature. Again, there's a story here an example of how we can make a mistake about this. I heard an interview with a rock and roll musician. I think he was one of those Seattle grunge rock musicians. And he was saying there was some event where they're in this kind of party or some kind of group event, and something distressing happens to his girlfriend in this event. And afterwards, he didn't respond to it, or something didn't happen. And someone asks him about that, well, why didn't you help her or do something like that? And he said something like, well, I was just so much in the moment, I didn't notice what was going on. Like, being in the moment was this profound thing, and it was an excuse for him not paying attention to what was going on with this person who he was significantly related to. And again, we see here there is this idea that if we're in the moment, if we're in that place where we are finding some deep peace or connection, that sense of connection, then that being in that place justifies a whole bunch of other stuff. In a sense, it justifies irresponsibility. And that thinking is mistaken from the perspective of practice. So to my mind, his statement, his using being in the moment as a justification for not paying attention, is a mistake. And it limits our experience of what the profound quality of Buddha nature is. there is, to my experience, the being in connection with Buddha nature is alive. This is the source of the life of this is the source of life. And it has a quality which is active and responsive and has within it compassion. So when it sees suffering, it asks the question, in a sense, what is my response to the suffering? What is the wise way of responding to suffering? Sometimes it might be, you know, oh yeah, I saw her in that distress. In the moment, I was aware of that, but there was nothing that I could do. So I sat as still as I could and waited till I could do something to address the issue, or I offered merit, or X, Y, or Z. There's a profound difference between that open and expansive understanding of being in the moment and that life of being in the moment and the closed quality that we want to put on it. To go back to that statement about if we want to have a deeper understanding of wisdom, we should work on compassion. Part of our activity of compassion is asking the question, how do I create suffering for myself? How do I create suffering for others? And what can I do about that? What can I change about myself to prevent that? How can I understand that better so that I can minimize that? This is the kind of work of compassion. Sometimes what that means then is being willing to look with clear eyes, honest eyes, at what's actually going on in our minds. Most of the time when we're closing down our experience of being in the moment, to use that phrase, we're doing that out of fear, and we're doing that out of wanting to cling to a pleasant experience. And so we need to be able to be willing to be honest and forthright about whether we're clinging to a pleasant experience or not. Sometimes the truth of our life leads us into a situation where we are required, not by external circumstances necessarily, but by our own kind of honesty, to deal with something difficult externally. And to be fully present in that process of dealing with that difficult thing, that is the practice of compassion, but it's also the practice of compassion deeply rooted in the experience and life of wisdom. By being willing to look into what is the difficulty here and to go into that in terms of meditation practice, that is how we work on compassion. And that's also how we find a deeper connection to the wisdom of the Buddha nature. We find that, oh, our fear was unfounded. We find that, oh, even when I let go of my experience of pleasant things, there's this deeper thing. There's this deeper thing which won't ever abandon me. It will never be gone, no matter how much I let go. There is this deeper truth which is present in all things, in all circumstances, in all conditions, and is not conditioned by anything. So I can continue to just let go and be in that lively spot of wisdom. And in that sense, it doesn't matter what goes on externally. Now, knowing that it doesn't matter what goes on externally is a really nice experience. It's pretty freeing and liberating, deeply freeing and liberating. But we can cling to that as well. We can cling to that and say, oh, it doesn't matter what I say, or it can be one way that it gets distorted is, I know this wisdom of freedom, and so whatever I do to help other people find that is justified. A lot of spiritual teachers have gotten into trouble on that one. And we have to be really, really careful with that, because we're distorting things, we're deluding ourselves. It's never, in a sense, justified for us to take a wrong action. And we will always get the consequences for our actions, no matter what state we are in, no matter how deeply we experience wisdom. And so compassion must be married to wisdom in that way. What is really deeply compassionate? Sometimes it means just sitting still and waiting for circumstances externally to change, so that we can take steps. Always being willing to respond. We talk about learning how to, in terms of meditation practice, how to be responsive to circumstances and not reactive. I have a whole collection of habits and patterns and methods of acting in the world. And a lot of that is just pretty automatic. It's just happens, and it's, you know, useful, it's good. But sometimes we realize our reactive patterns just aren't helpful anymore. We need to really work on how to let go of reaction and how to be responsible. The Dharma never gives us, it never says we should not be responsible to the commitments and real life circumstances that we live in. We always need to be responsible in that sense, in that external kind of worldly sense, if you will. And when we bring our practice of letting go to taking responsibility, then that can help us to open up a deeper understanding of what wisdom is. And that taking responsibility, again, comes out of compassion. For Buddhism itself, and there are lots of different spiritual traditions, but for Buddhism itself, again, the Buddha started with compassion. What can I do about this problem of suffering? And as followers of the Buddha, that's kind of how we orient ourselves. We don't necessarily personally, you know, have to be kind of motivated in the same way that he was, but in order to take on the Buddha's teaching and to say, okay, how do I understand this? How do I make it work in my life? That's where he's coming from. That's where we need to understand he's coming from. That's where the Dharma is coming from. Is what do we do about suffering in its most profound, in the most profound way that we can? And the practice of meditation and the cultivation of wisdom, then it, again, is a response to that question. How do I deal with suffering? How do I deal with the difficulty of the world? And if you want to understand that experience of wisdom, then we really need to understand the deep connection between it and suffering and the deep connection between it and compassion. I think that's what I have to say today. Are there any questions?
You did mention, you said teachers can get in trouble by, can you go over that again and expand on that just a little bit? By taking it too far or kind of taking liberties?
You can. Let's see. The classic way that Buddhist teachers have gotten into trouble in the West is that they have, say, become sexually involved with their students and then justified that involvement because of their own experience of wisdom and said, this is both okay for me to do because I have this deep experience of wisdom and I can let this go. And the suffering that is caused by, in some cases, the person has been involved with a number of different people, the suffering that is caused by, to these other people is, to go back to that crass statement of the person who was on trial in Canada, their suffering is their suffering, and they need to deal with their suffering, and it's not my responsibility. And this comes back to a misunderstanding of wisdom, a misunderstanding of the use of wisdom, the misunderstanding of the actuality of wisdom. It is a classic problem, actually, in Buddhism, which is addressed by a classic story called Yakujo's Fox, and which is a story of a Zen teacher who's giving a lecture to a bunch of monks, and everybody leaves. I can't remember the exact details of the story. Everybody leaves the lecture hall except for one person, and that monk stays and asks him whether a Zen master is bound by, is freed from the law of karma, is independent of a law of karma. Someone who is awakened to the truth is independent of the law of karma. And this Zen teacher tells this monk, no, a Zen teacher is not free from the law of karma. And so the person leaves, and I think he says, oh, he has this kind of awakening to the truth. He says, oh, that's great, that really helps me. In 500 previous lifetimes, I've been born as a fox because I taught that a Zen teacher was freed from the law of karma and independent of the law of karma. And so the teacher says, okay, great, no, because that's not true. A Zen master is always bound by the law of karma. Because we have this, because part of the experience of wisdom, part of the experience that we can have is this great sense of freedom. I mean, for myself, I know that I have the experience of being able to make a mistake and know that that actually doesn't, that's just a mistake. It doesn't actually make any difference in terms of my relationship to Buddha nature. But it is a mistake and it has consequences. Now, there's a sense in which I can just say, oh, that's just a mistake. I can just let it go and carry on. And I'm, in a way, not really affected by that. And I have to say, when I make a mistake and it hurts somebody, it could be years before that experience stops going through my mind and stops affecting me. And I, on the level of my mind and my life and my experience. And I can see that actions that I've done in the past have long-term consequences for other people. And I don't want that to happen for them. I want them to not be suffering. My sense of compassion is such that I just think, God, what an idiot I am for having done that thing. So both of those things can exist at the same time, and in a way need to exist at the same time, so that we can continue to deepen our practice of wisdom and seeing that wisdom is another name for being in harmony with Buddha nature, which is that, you know, kind of deep reality of life that includes both all three, compassion, love, and wisdom. And so some spiritual teachers in this country have made quite serious mistakes and left quite a serious wake of suffering behind them because of this, even though they personally might have had a legitimate experience of wisdom where they kind of know that it's empty, all of this is empty, and will just resolve itself in no time, really. still there is this need, this requirement in a way that suffering be present. And then to, you know, kind of expand on that, we will always be living in the world of consequences. As long as we're made of meat, as long as we have a body, as long as we are alive in this world, there will always be consequences acting upon us. As we go along, we can study deeply and see what those consequences are, whether they're karmic consequences or physical consequences or consequences in the realm of science or whatever those consequences are, social consequences. We will always need to be present in that world of consequences. That's where we live. That's where most of our time is spent. And by knowing deeply this state of Buddha nature, this being one with Buddha nature, this living in the Buddha mind, it does vastly, radically change our life in the world of consequences. And from that place, then we can ask the question, how is it wise to change my behavior to harmonize with that world of consequences? How is it wise for me to proceed forward in that world of consequences skillfully, both for whatever my purpose in life is? For my purpose in life, it is to follow and fulfill the bodhisattva vows. How can I help beings? And so how can I, in a wise way, do that? Part of my purpose in that bodhisattva vow is to teach about the Dharma. How can I proceed in a wise way which listens to and hears the various facets of the culture that I'm living in, the world that I'm living in, and responds in a wise way? You know, part of the thing was Reverend Master Rooks, I was talking about this morning about the studies about willpower and meditation. I think that's really great. It just really encourages people. Part of, though, what's going on in the world is this kind of idea that we can just live in the world of science and forget about the world of the spiritual, where it kind of ignores meditation in a way. Because in my experience, stuff can happen in meditation that just isn't explained by science, and is, in fact, you know, eschewed by science. Another idea for a Dharma talk I had once was, my religion is not science. Even though I kind of love science, it's one of my favorite things, you know, it helps me a lot, I think. But there is a deeper place where we can go, which is in a way beyond consequence, but helps us in the world of consequence. We can never discard the world of consequence, but we always need to keep in mind there is this deeper place. And that radically changes our relationship to the world of consequence. Okay. Any other questions?